Now is the time for our reading, and it comes from Deuteronomy chapter 5, verses 1 to 21, and also chapter 6, verses 4 to 9. Moses summoned all Israel and said, "Hear, O Israel, the decrees and the laws I declare in your hearing today. Learn them and be sure to follow them. The Lord our God made a covenant with us at Horeb. It was not with our fathers that the Lord made this covenant, but with us, with all of us who are alive here today. The Lord spoke to you face to face out of the fire on the mountain. At that time, I stood between the Lord and you to declare to you the word of the Lord because you were afraid of the fire and did not go up the mountain. And he said, 'I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sins of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Observe the Sabbath day by keeping it holy, as the Lord your God has commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son or daughter, nor your manservant or maidservant, nor your ox, your donkey, or any of your animals, nor the alien within your gates, so that your manservant and maidservant may rest as you do. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and that the Lord your God brought you out of there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God has commanded you to observe the Sabbath day. Honor your father and your mother, as the Lord your God has commanded you, so that you may live long and that it may go well with you in the land the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife. You shall not set your desire on your neighbor's house or land, his manservant or maidservant, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor.'" And then chapter 6, verse 4. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. These commandments that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates."
Thank you, Casey. Hello again, everyone. You can be a bit rowdier now. You're a quiet bunch. It makes me nervous, honestly. I need a bit more. I almost wish I had to tell you to be quiet sometimes, you know? Shh. There we go. Thanks. Thanks, Bonnie. That's helpful. Right. Has anyone ever read the book or seen the film The Lord of the Flies? Yes. Good. Good. It's a bit of a modern classic. And that book is, I don't think I've read the book, but the film has always made an impression on me. Now, if you don't know the story of The Lord of the Flies, it's set in some wartime. I'm not sure which wartime it is. And during an evacuation of some children, a British plane comes down somewhere in an obscure part of the Pacific Ocean. And the only survivors from this plane are a bunch of pre-adolescent boys, which is already a recipe for disaster. And on this island, there are no rules. There's no higher authority. There's no common unity. Nothing that sort of binds these boys together. Maybe a couple of them know each other. And so the film plays out what will happen. How will these boys survive? Will they survive? Will they rise to the challenge? And at first in the film, what we see is a bit of survival instinct kicks in and a little bit of unity. So they separate into groups. Some become hunters to go and look for food. Some are charged with setting up tents or things for them to sleep in. And, it's an okay start. But what happens as the film goes on is that as these boys face their fears, face mounting challenges to their survival, but also their inner impulses and desires, they gradually descend into deeper and darker acts of savagery, ending in murder. And the story is a kind of a parable, in a sense. And it's a parable about the conflicting human impulses that are within us. The impulse to unity and to work together, to harmony, to peace, and to rules. But also this inner impulse to power and to domination. And I wonder if the book's become a bit of a modern classic because it touches on something that is in all of us and that we see in the world around about us, these conflicting desires within us. Which one or which ones will win? Paul in the New Testament recognized that fight when he talked about, oh, what a man I am. The good I want to do, I can't do. The evil I don't want to do, I end up doing. Who will rescue me from this body of death? It's a common part of the human experience. Now, the story, Lord of the Flies, I think has a lot of parallels or echoes in the stories we've been looking at as we've gone through the book of Genesis. The stories right at the start of the Bible. A story that begins with human innocence, but then descends into deeper and deeper trouble as humans become mastered by their own desires. The propensity to give in to selfishness, to greed, to violence. And humanity becomes divided when these impulses are left unchecked. You see it with the story of Adam and Eve at the start. Again, made in innocence, put in this amazing world to enjoy, but unable to live within healthy limits, wanting to go that bit further to play God. That leads to the story of Cain and Abel, a story of envy that turns to bitterness and murder. Then we go to Babel, the Tower of Babel, pride and desire leading to this seeking of empire and power. And we could go on with Abraham and Isaac and Ishmael and Jacob. All these stories about this battle within, these inner impulses that if they're not taken care of, end up mastering us. So I think the book of Genesis and the story of humanity in the beginning of the Bible is a narrative that warns us of the human propensity to play God and the tragic consequences of being mastered by our own desires. And I think that's the story we find ourselves in still today. And the genius of Genesis, I think, is that it's not academic. It doesn't just talk about these things on an academic level. It places them in the context of real stories of people's ordinary day-to-day lives, in families, in communities, and in the world around. And I say the world around because ordinary lives, our lives, everybody's lives, they're played out in a context, aren't they? We live our lives in a bigger story. You know, we make our individual decisions on a daily basis, sometimes oblivious to how we're being formed within a particular context. So, for example, In the West, we're a very consumeristic culture. We are being formed and influenced and shaped to buy more and want more. Someone once said, you know, they've never heard a sermon preached on the 10th commandment, do not covet, because our whole system is built on coveting. That's what we're designed to do, to want what someone else has got and then buy it. And in other cultures, you know, you are what you produce. It's about work, work, work. That's the bigger story that people's lives are built in. And in still others, people are programmed to kill, to see the other as an enemy, to be destroyed, a threat. And these bigger stories are often unquestioned, but they're so important because they form us and they shape us in a particular image. Now we jump to today's passage, and a bigger story that the Israelites were a part of. And this particular passage today is part of the defining story of the Old Testament, the defining story of the people of Israel. And it's the Exodus, the liberation from Egypt. Now the Israelites, we know, they'd found themselves in slavery in Egypt under Pharaoh, under a cruel regime. And here's the thing that I noticed in preparing for this. People who end up in slavery often don't know it's happening. It's not kind of, right, you're captured, you're in slavery. It can be, but often it's a gradual process. And these Israelites had once been prominent in the land through Joseph, but gradually over time, they ended up in slavery, which I think is a parallel for many of us today. We don't realize what we're ending up in sometimes, the situations. Anyway, they find themselves in this slavery, and God hears their cries, the cries of the oppressed. And he raises up Moses as a liberator to free them from under the hand of Pharaoh. And to cut a long story short, Moses leads the people out of their oppression in Egypt. And they're going to inherit a promised land. And God makes a covenant with them. He says, I will be your God, and you will be my people. I will be your God, and you will be my people. We didn't plan that. The thing is about this story that's just the beginning. It's always just the beginning. Getting people out of slavery is one thing, but getting the slavery out of the people is an entirely different thing altogether. And that is the story of the rest of the Old Testament. This is the beginning. God liberates people from slavery. He rescues them from the hand of Pharaoh. But the tricky bit is going to be getting the slavery out of the people. Because, like all of us, they were formed, they were programmed, they were influenced and shaped by the context they were in. And you see it time and again in the Old Testament. They revert back to slavery, to being slaves. They may not be under the hand of the Egyptians, but they live as those people, those slaves. And so enter the Ten Commandments. God makes a covenant with the people. As I've said, you'll be my people, I will be your God. And it's in the context of this covenant, this relationship that God makes with the Israelites, that he gives the Ten Commandments. You know, you can read the Ten Commandments and think, oh gosh, that's just a list of rules. They sound a bit negative. But if you understand them in the context they're in, a people that have been in slavery, given freedom, they really start to make sense. Has anyone seen the film The Shawshank Redemption? It's a brilliant film, and it's another one that was such an amazing parallel for me. But there's a bit in this film where this chap has been institutionalized. He's been in prison for most of his life. And when he's released and given his freedom, he doesn't know what to do with it. He doesn't know how to live as a free man. And he ends up taking his own life. He's not programmed for this. He's been programmed to be a prisoner. to be institutionalized, to be told what to do when. So God gives the Israelites the Ten Commandments. They're first found in Exodus chapter 20, and then they're repeated here in Deuteronomy 5 as Moses looks back and interprets the law again, reinterprets it for the people of every generation. Commandments, it can also be interpreted as 10 sayings or 10 words, or the Decalogue is sometimes called. Now, I really love board games, and I know some of you in this room do too. There's a point to what I'm about to say here. I really do love board games. And whenever you're given a board game, you're given this often very beautiful board and all the pieces and stuff, but you're also given a set of rules or instructions to go with the game, aren't you? They're a vital part of the gift of the board game. If you think about, you know, Christmas time, you're given this complex game. Oh, that looks great. The pieces look wonderful. But you're not given any instructions, any rules on how to play the game. It's going to be completely pointless, isn't it? You don't give someone a game and say, oh, make up the rules as you go. You'll figure it out. Or you don't say, do whatever feels right, because that wouldn't lead to a particularly cohesive game. But the rules aren't also imposed to restrict your freedom or your fun or enjoyment of the game. They're just a vital part of what makes it work, of how to do it, so that you can enjoy it and it can fulfill its purpose. The rules are a vital part of the gift. And the Ten Commandments are the same. They're a necessary part for the people of Israel. They were a necessary part of the gift of freedom. 10 words, 10 sayings, 10 commandments that, if lived by, would promote life, life with God, life with neighbor. It says it in Leviticus 18. God says, keep my decrees and laws, for the person who obeys them will live by them. I am the Lord. They will live by them. So what of them, the Ten Commandments? I don't know if you've ever looked at them in any depth, but the Ten Commandments can be divided roughly in two, 4 and 6. And the first 4 commandments are all to do with our relationship, the people's relationship to God. No other gods before me. Do not take the Lord's name in vain. Keep the Sabbath, etc. And the following 6 are all to do with how you treat your neighbor. Do not commit adultery. Do not murder. Do not covet, etc. Honor your father and mother. I think that is so crucial in how we read the commandments. Because you know what? You can be completely zealous for God, for your faith, for your religion, whatever it might be, but treat your neighbor terribly. And it becomes pointless. A lecturer at Bible College pointed out that in a particular translation of or interpretation of the Jewish law or Jewish tradition, that the commandments were written on both sides, showing that love for God and love for neighbor are actually two sides of the same coin. You cannot have one without the other. This is a theme that is picked up in so many other places in the Bible. You know, in John writes, whoever claims to love God yet hates a brother or sister is a liar. For whoever does not love their brother and sister whom they have seen cannot love God whom they have not seen. This is such an important message for today, where a lot of people claim the name Christian or whatever religion it might be and have such zeal and passion for it, yet can abuse or make decisions that harm their brother or sister. I know for myself on a really personal level, when I became a Christian when I was 16, and I've told this story before, that I became such a zealous Puritan. I was all or nothing. It was everything now. This is it. This is what my life is going to be about. And I became, honestly, the things I did in the name of my faith, embarrassing to look back on now. And my brother shared a few of them in his speech at my wedding. But what happened was I became so passionate about God that I became particularly judgmental of people that weren't. And it harmed some of my relationships. I was judgmental in my family. I was judgmental at school, and I separated myself from people around me because they weren't as passionate as I was or as good as I was. Little did I know. Love for God is not separate from love for neighbor. They are two sides of the same coin. Jesus says exactly that when he says, whenever you feed the hungry, give a drink to the thirsty, take care of the lonely, those in prison, you do it for me. You do it for me. They're so interlinked. But what of the goal of the commandments then? The goal of the commandments was not to, as someone said, to inform, but to transform. The commandments were not just laws to be written down on stones and put in an ark, the Ark of the Covenant. They were to be lived out in community, to form these people into a new kind of people, to get the slavery out of the people. Because God knew, and one thing to notice about these commandments is, they're almost exclusively prohibitive. Have you noticed that? They're not burdens to put on people's backs. You must do this, you must do this, and you must do this. These are my rules. They're just, don't do that. Don't do that, and don't do that. And they sound negative, but actually they're warnings. They're not burdens on people's backs, they're warnings about dangers that we might not see, that if we make this decision, it might be your impulse now, it might feel right to you now, but it will wreak havoc that you know nothing about. I was going to use an example of a swimming pool, but I'm going to use a different example from this morning, because I sprinted through those double doors this morning and nearly knocked Pauline off her feet, who happened to be carrying all these trays of communion wine. And honestly, it was centimetres, wasn't it, Pauline, between us and absolute disaster. Now, I could have done with a sign there that says, do not run. I was thinking about the swimming pool, you know, where it has a sign saying, do not run. When you're a kid and you've just come down the slide or jumped off the diving board, all you want to do is run. But the wiser people, the people in authority know, that floor is slippy, and if you run, you are liable to break your neck or arm or something along those lines. And so the commandment is put in place not to prohibit fun, but to promote life and fun, to make it an environment that is safe. Now, of course, the Israelites were prone to do what any of us, I think, are prone to do, which is to make something that isn't the main thing, and to miss the entire point altogether. And the risk for the Israelites, I think, was this, that they made the commandments, the rules, the point. They made them the thing that was the relationship with God, if that makes sense. They risk becoming slaves again, but a different kind of slave. Slaves to the rules, essentially. Slave to the commandments. Slavishly obeying them and enforcing them, regardless of the context. Rules are good, but rules are like primary school. And you've got to graduate from rules to secondary school, which is more like wisdom, knowing how to apply the rules. And You know, Jesus came on the scene into a culture where the religious authorities were slavishly obeying the rules and saying, God's will isn't being done on earth because we're not obeying the rules to the letter of the law. People aren't living up to the right standard. And Jesus came and challenged that view. And he said, there's one particular occasion where him and his disciples were walking through a field and they started picking grain on the Sabbath and eating it. And the religious leader said, that's unlawful on the Sabbath. That's work. You're picking grain. And Jesus said to them something really poignant. He said, the Sabbath wasn't... No, I'm going to get this the wrong way around now. Man wasn't made for the Sabbath, but the Sabbath for man. Because do you know what? When our ancestors were brought out of Egypt, he didn't say this, but I'm reading into it now. When our ancestors were brought out of Egypt and this law was given, they were worked like machines. They were only useful for what they could do and what they could produce. And God gave them this law to say, no, that's not true. You are human beings. You need rest. And that is a crucial part of what it means to be human. And that is a crucial part of getting slavery out of the people. Rules are good, but wisdom is better. But love is best of all. And that's the third graduation, if you like. If rules are like primary school and wisdom is like secondary school, though if you're a secondary school teacher, you'd probably debate whether there's much wisdom in a secondary school. I don't know. Love is best of all. The context that these commandments were given in were a loving relationship. So the commandments in themselves only point to something much greater. And Jesus, again, reinterprets this for a new day, for the context he's living in. Jesus challenges the religious leaders for, you know, just doing what they can get away with. Yeah, the law says, do not murder. Of course, and you're not murdering, fine. But anyone that says to his brother, you fool, is in danger of the fires of hell, he says. It's one thing to say, do not commit adultery, but anyone that looks at a woman with lust has committed adultery in his heart. He says the commandments essentially are one end of a spectrum that point to something far greater. They create a culture in which we can love God, rules by which we know how to love God. And that's where we get to the Shema. Shema means hear. And Orthodox Jews still recite this prayer twice a day. Once in the morning and one at night. And I think that's amazing. That's brilliant to remind us that at the context, at the heart of this whole covenant thing with God is love. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, from the center of who you are, with all your mind, with your intellect, with all your soul, and with all your strength, with your body, with your very being. And so Jesus, when he's asked by a religious leader of his day, what's the greatest commandment? He sums it up by saying, love. Love God. And love your neighbor as yourself. This sums up the law and the prophets. So, for us, what role can the Ten Commandments play in our lives? Well, firstly, I think it's remembering that the commandments are given in the context of something much more important, and that's relationship with God. A God who wants us to live in freedom. who wants to take us out of slavery. Slavery to ourselves, to our addictions, our own ways of thinking, to the things that the decisions we make that harm us and harm others. But then to keep us out of slavery, to love God and to love our neighbor and not be slaves to anything. And for me, the Ten Commandments are an amazing, almost litmus test for some of that. So this week, I took the chance to, I thought, how can I use the Ten Commandments in my own life? And I just took them one by one and used them as the basis of a prayer. So, Simon, you shall have no other gods before me. Lord, what have I made a god in my life this week? What am I trying to serve? What am I giving myself to? And just allowing that to sit and for God to highlight anything there. And then coming back, you shall have no other gods before me. When have I taken God's name in vain or cheapened it? When have I not rested? When have I felt like I'm just what I produce, etc.? And I could go on and on. And taking those as the framework of a prayer, not to become slaves to them, but as a litmus test in my relationship with God, who invites me to love him with all my heart, soul, and strength, and to love my neighbor as myself. Let's pray.